God. So I learned maybe a week or two ago that Steve was unable to make it, and after trying to find some suitable replacements, Todd told me that this was going to be my first official as incoming division chair of C1. So I thought this would be a great opportunity to put together some concepts that I find myself talking to people on a one-on-one basis a lot about, and I don't necessarily hear a lot of people talking about out in the open, okay? And so part of this is the limitations of molecular quantitative genetics and how we really use it to improve crops. And so part of this is shifting the pendulum back to a focus of crop improvement. So really the goal here is, and this, as Todd has mentioned, we'll have a discussion section after this, so I really wanted to stimulate some conversations, maybe say some provocative things and use the philosophy part of a PhD degree. I wanted to understand why molecular quantitative genetics has not met all community expectations, and then thoughts on how the community might continue to pursue molecular quantitative genetics. Because I will say some things that may be provocative to some of you, these are not necessarily the views of Texas A&M or the USDA Office of Chief Scientist, who I normally might represent. But this audience, probably a lot of you have already recognized these, so it may be somewhat reactionary. But as I go talk to especially more basic plant biologists, I hear a lot of things that sometimes are a little bit strange, thinking about what the goal of crop science or crop improvement are. And for me, it's to develop new sustainable, both economic and environmental, solutions for agriculture. Okay, but I really geek out about some of the science, like some of the excellent work that Dr. Patterson was just talking about. And I think those are really the key for our long-term crop improvement. So I hear a lot, especially from students, that there's this major goal to clone every gene in the genome. And for those of you not familiar with the technology or the terminology, generally what that means is to understand the function and to prove that function of the gene. And so then there's this idea that we'll be able to use these genes in crop improvement or in synthetic biology. And so I see this as sort of a unicorn hypothesis. It's sort of unattainable. It's sort of a fantasy. But I see it sort of as a zombie unicorn because it doesn't seem to want to die sometimes, despite evidence to the contrary. So the Arabidopsis 2010-2020 project, that was a good example of we want to clone every gene, and I don't think they've really completely succeeded on that. So at first people were saying we could do this if we had a genome sequence, right? And the Human Genome Project tried that, and then they learned that there were a lot more complications to biology than just having genomics data. And then we heard, at least in the molecular quantitative genetics field, if only we had more genotype, only if we had more markers. And so next-generation sequencing came along, and I still don't think we've cracked the nut of understanding or cloning all the genes in the genome. So then, you know, if only we had more research money, if only we had bigger populations or more individuals, I'm not saying it's not possible, but I think there's a lot more complications than a simple one-off study. So let's go back and look at why we might map or clone QTLs. And this is a slide I use in my PhD level class all the time. So for mapping QTL, we might want to understand the control of the trait. I think that's one of the most common ways that mapping QTL started. What's the inheritance position co-localization? We might want to have molecular markers for marker-assisted selection, another worthy goal. We might want to identify homology with other species. And I think there used to be a lot of really outstanding studies that did this with QTL, and now we're seeing it being done with genome sequence. But to go to the next step, to actually map-based clone or somehow clone a gene, is a lot more expensive proposition. And sometimes people think that they might want to do this for a perfect marker for mass, so that's probably not the best use of resources. We might want to do it so we can transform something, so we can knock it out, so we can turn it off or overexpress it. I'm really excited about the idea of identifying genetic pathways. I mean, what's the genetic pathway for yield or for plant height or stem sugar? If we identify one gene, we can look at what they interact with. We might want to look at homology across species in these genes. What do these genes do? And then a really, really exciting thing is once we identify a gene, we can go into the germplasm bank and look for diverse alleles at that and test their function, hypothesize their function. These are all very exciting things to do. Now, just doing a literature search, we see the steady growth of articles, and I'm now a maize breeder and work on maize genetics, and so maize is the focus here, and we see a steady growth of maize articles, probably over 1,500 a year in recent years. We also see a steady growth of titles with QTL and GWAS and genomic selection in the title, and what that leads me to believe is that in some cases, the methodology has become the subject of the research. You know, finding a QTL has become the subject of the research rather than crop improvement. And that's okay, but I think we need to clearly specify that that may be the case sometimes. So there is a steady growth of these articles. Now, what really brought this to the forefront for me was an NPR story in August when I heard the human medical community is having trouble applying some of these alleles that it's discovered, that they're not resulting in the predictions that they thought they would. Okay, and to me, it was sort of like, well, no duh, we've known that in plants for a long time. You know, there's obvious problems that people in the medical community recognize. There's population structure. There's explicit population structure we can control for. There's cryptic population structure that's pretty tough to get around, and dwarf fate's a great example of that. There's a lot of making inferences, especially using European populations, to try and make inferences to disease in more diverse populations. That's problematic. But in humans, rare alleles and small population sizes are also another major set of problems. And then there's probably a lot of unknown and unacknowledged issues. So I think one thing we don't talk about enough is what's the goal of our specific population under study. And this is really true in humans, where we're trying to make inferences to larger and non-representative populations. So I do a lot of near-infrared spectroscopy, but this is very similar to genomic selection. The figure on the right is a low variance, high bias type of calibration. That would be like a recombinant inbred line population, for instance, where you have a very narrow genetic background and you're trying to make specific predictions on that genetic background. But as soon as you go to apply it to a different population, it falls apart. So we can do that with low variance, but it's going to have a high bias. The alternative is to develop a calibration that incorporates all the diversity. But then, of course, we're going to have low prediction power. It's not going to look as sexy when we go to publish it. Right? And so that's often what we'll see when we use a diversity panel. Now, rare alleles are a little bit of a different problem that the human medical community might have to deal with, but in the plant science community, we don't really get too worked up about them. A site frequency spectrum shows that rare alleles are the most common type of variation, and I think some of the recent sequencing work has shown 500 to 700 mutations in every individual are novel. But if we look at the tools we're using, many of the SNPs are going to be either missed or biased when we use next-generation sequencing tools, right? If you see one individual with a rare allele, we're tending to throw it out. So we probably underestimate these things quite a bit. So let's go and look at the methodological waves of molecular quantitative genetics. So early in 1986, you know, a number of pioneers are in the room in QTL linkage mapping. A lot of that has to do with making biparental populations. Using linkage, low numbers of markers are okay. And at first, I think it was for improvement. It's also for knowledge generation. But the alleles are enriched from being rare to being more common in these linkage populations. Now, in diverse association mapping studies, we usually pool diverse individuals to improve our resolution. And so we get a lot of those rare alleles that we can't do a lot with. Again, I think this is probably more for knowledge than improvement. And this new wave that we see of genomic selection has a totally different focus. Instead of finding genes or finding loci as QTL or association mapping, we're really trying to select the best individual. It's getting back to plant breeding. Now, I have some questions on whether or not this is going to be something that academics can publish in 5 or 20 years, because there's not necessarily going to be something that you can, you know, report that other people can use. Now, if you identify a QTL or a gene, that's something you can publish on. So I think that's one thing the community is really going to need to work out in the future, is this going to be primarily a tool of the private sector and the few applied breeding programs, or is there something publishable there? So the main barriers left to identifying gene function in plants, in my opinion, are small effects. This is a huge, huge problem, especially in maize. Too many allele combinations to test, a lack of effective recombination, pervasive epistasis and context dependency. I think this is probably the biggest problem. G by E and error is too great in mass genetics effects. And finally, funding, because trying to account for all these things is very challenging. So I'm just going to run through these real quick. Small effects in the infinitesimal model. So a lot of these things, I don't think we have a direct study that proves, without a shadow of a doubt, that this is the overarching you know, mantra in the plant science community. But I think there's little pieces of evidence, and this is sort of my gut feeling. So mostly what we see is that the major genes are the ones that are being cloned and identified. The small effect ones are very difficult. A great example of this is the NAM in maize. If you look at the bottom left-hand figure from the Butler et al. Paper, you can see the largest effect is about one day for flowering time. So if you try and develop a neuroisogenic line to actually prove that that one-day effect is there, you better have some really outstanding precision phenotyping. And when we go to the most common effects, which are fractions of a day, there's almost, you know, nothing that can measure that. But by identifying all of these, you can develop a predictive model, of course. And that's what the figure on the other side is. By summing up the allelic effects, we can actually develop something meaningful. But most of these effects are so small that it's almost going to be impossible to ever prove without a shadow of a doubt that there is some function. Another great piece of evidence is that genomic selection is working better than marker-assisted selection for most people, from my understanding. And then I guess the last part to just mention is, you know, we can statistically detect them, but are they biologically meaningful? Okay? And especially with the Bevis effect, overestimating some of those alleles. Now, too many allele combinations to test. Corn, it's estimated, has about 32,000 genes. From what I've seen, there's anywhere between 2 and 100 alleles per gene. So if we do the math on this, that's 2 to the 30,000 potential combinations. So I just wanted to see how many zeros were there, so I tried to put it into Excel. The maximum you can do in Excel is 2 to the 1023, which gives you 8 to the E307. It's estimated that there's only 10 to the 24th stars in the galaxy. Okay? So there's a lot more potential combinations of genes than there are stars in the galaxy. So that's something I think a lot of us forget sometimes, is trying to somehow get these all stacked is going to be extremely difficult. And in maize, what we're seeing is there may be 5,000 genes missing in one line relative to another line. So this makes the problem almost completely intractable. We make a little bit of improvement every year, but there's no way we're ever going to optimize an individual with all of these. And then to make this a little more challenging, more than half of the SNPs are rare in a diversity panel. So we're going to need to recombine these somehow. And I believe that there's really not enough recombination to isolate these loci. That's a major problem. So people say use association mapping. Okay, we have rare alleles. We have some other problems there. But 52 base pairs in maize is about the resolution of a haplotype using GWAS. But we need to somehow redistribute those to actually isolate gene effects. And so that brings us back to linkage mapping. When we look at linkage mapping, I still have an open question of, to what extent is a QTL a sum of many loci versus one major loci underlying it? And I think Susan Micucci's group did some nice work I like to present in my grad class where they dissected a QTL and actually found many opposing effects underneath that QTL. When we do association, we tend to find smaller effects and fewer effects than in linkage mapping. And is that really a result just of dissecting those linkage blocks, of isolating those loci so we don't have the summation effect? I think that's also another open question. So in my program, because I believe recombination is so important, we decided to try and address this and look at the effect of recombination in linkage mapping. So we developed this massive magic population, multiple generation intercross population, using four parents, and you can see them there at the top. We made the two-way crosses between two of the parents and developed about 130 inbred lines, which is fairly standard still, sadly, in QTL mapping. And then on the other side, we have about 130 of the two ways developed down to rills. But we also made the four-way cross, and there's 117 of those in rills, and then we started intermating, one generation, two generations, and three generations is the largest population with 515 inbred lines. So in total, we had an effective population size of about 1,200 individuals. And so what we find is, even with a subset of just the four parent crosses, extremely high power to detect QTLs with high resolution. If you look at the LOD score there, it's I think it's a little over 80. Not only that, but the resolution on that was really exciting for me. We were able to detect the causal polymorphism to 54 base pairs for the yellow allele in maize. And this is with a linkage mapping population. However, once we started breaking it down and saying, well, what if we had used the smaller populations, we actually found for one of the four-way populations without intermating, we would not have detected that locus. And then more so, if we had done bootstrapping, and we had just developed small populations of 121 individuals, You can see there in the red on the left-hand side of the figure, those are where the predicted QTL is, which totally misses the peak. So we would have been in the wrong position. In some cases, we don't detect it. In other cases, we miss the QTL altogether for a major Mendelian gene. Now, when 242 individuals are used, we do a little bit better. And so as Jesse Poland told me before I even started this, why are you worried about recombination? You really just need more individuals. It turned out to be fairly true. So a Mendelian trait is one thing. We're really interested in mapping all the genes in the genome and cloning all of them, right? So what about a quantitative trait? Well, if you look at the LOD score here for the only QTL across environments in this population, you can see the LOD score is much lower. And we only identify one QTL. It happens to be pleiotropic with flowering time, and we embarrassingly miss the QTL a number of times when we bootstrap small populations out of this. Okay? So this really suggests that QTL mapping, we really need enormously large populations, even for linkage mapping, to really get at all the loci in the genome. So the second to last major topic I want to cover real quick is pervasive epistasis and context dependency. So when people tell me I want to find the gene for this, I usually have to backtrack a little bit and explain the problems that we've seen with epistasis and context dependency. And the problem with this is that it's so complicated and there's so little evidence because you need such large populations to really detect it. Now, Trudy McKay published in 2014 a brilliant review article that shows that most epistasis occurs in the absence of main effects. So what does that mean? It means if you first detect your major effect loci and look for epistasis there, you're not going to find it. Because those loci actually tend to work broadly across the population. It's the things you don't detect. And so if you have 100,000 markers, then the number of tests you have to conduct is 100,000 times 99,999. So it's very difficult to detect these things. And if we're talking about a whole genome background effect, it's even more challenging. But I think there's some evidence from the lower rate of detection in association mapping diversity panels as opposed to linkage mapping. And then that's also shown a little bit when you look at human QTL studies versus mouse QTL studies. In human QTL studies, you have diverse populations, you have twins, whereas in inbred lines of mice, the background is much more uniform. And so you find much higher rates of detection in mice with LOD scores and power than you do in humans. And I'll show you in just a minute how loci found through association mapping probably have less epistasis than linkage mapping. The mapping-as-you-go approach has been very successful. That suggests that epistasis is real. When we make NILs in different backgrounds, we find they have different effects. Again, if you're looking at a different genetic background in the same allele, you would expect the same effect. So that supports some epistasis and context dependency. And then finally, inbred loci and alleles are not predictive for hybrid gain, which is something that I see the community doing quite often is mapping in inbred lines and then trying to say they'll be useful for crop improvement when really it's only in a hybrid situation that allele would likely have an agronomic effect. So just real briefly, three-gene epistasis, there's 27 categories. So if we want to have any statistical power to estimate the effects in any one of these three-gene epistasis categories, and we're only looking at three genes, we're going to need a number of individuals probably greater than 100. So there's no way we can detect epistasis with 100 individuals across all 30,000 genes in the genome. So I'll just show you one other little result from our program. We conducted some GWAS on a test cross hybrid panel, so 350 diversity lines, test crossed them to a Texas-derived inbred line that's very similar to B73, looked for associations for aflatoxin. Primarily we found associations for yield and plant height. Okay, so that was very exciting to me. Yield is an exciting thing to find an association for. The next question is, are these real? So Dr. Yanyan Chen, who just got her PhD last week, took this project on. We decided we would develop linkage mapping populations out of our breeding program, okay, to try and validate these QTV, or quantitative trait variants, from the association panel. And what we actually found was across three different populations, we would find a consistent effect between the inbred and the hybrid, and between all three different populations, suggesting that those alleles that were found through genome-wide association studies had very little epistasis. which makes sense because you're finding them across a very diverse set of genetic backgrounds. Now, the interesting thing is, and I'm not as confident in this data because we didn't have great phenotypic data for mapping the QTL, but although we found QTL in inbreds and hybrids in all three populations, in no case were they the same QTL. Also, in no case did we find the same QTL in all three populations despite growing them in the same environment. We did find two QTL because they shared one of the same parent. So this again suggests that maybe same population, association results provided an allele that didn't have a lot of epistatic effects, whereas in linkage mapping, we're getting a lot more of things that are subject to the genetic background. The last thing I'm going to mention that makes everything very, very complicated is G by E. I want to remind people that we measure phenotypes. That's the only thing we can actually measure. Everything else is estimated through some type of statistical model. So we're trying to work our way back up to that genetic effect. But we have to get through the error and the replications and the G by E and the environment and the field spatial variation, which is, I agree, incredibly important, to estimate the genotypes. So you have all these complexities. Before, if you wanted to estimate epistasis, you would have to work through all those to have enough power left in that genetic term to actually estimate epistasis. So I'm not going to go through this slide, but I asked you to think at the beginning, you know, what's the point of a crop science program or a crop breeding program or your research program? And I think we can have all different types of answers here, but I think it's important to characterize that sometimes mapping QTL is not necessarily going to lead to cloning genes, which is not going to necessarily lead to crop improvement. It's not that they're not worthy or good ideas. It's just that those things do not have a direct correlation all the time. So I tried to put things in different colors, so products in green, and more basic molecular studies in yellow, and then more applied studies in blue. And I think you can see there's really a lot of different goals you can have in a crop science program. And they're all worthy and deserve further explanation. So in summary, I personally believe that identifying the functions of all genes is impossible. Maybe through some new approach that's not yet been developed, but through a molecular quantitative genetics and genomics approach. I think there's more feasible approaches to crop improvement. What I'm very excited about is high-throughput phenotyping. But I still believe molecular quantitative genetics is really useful for three purposes. To build a body of knowledge, as we saw from Dr. Patterson's talk, it takes a number of studies to feel confident about a location of a QTL. We need to identify some case studies to actually get at genes and underlying pathways, and I think we need to use these studies to continue to train students. And so a final point here is that genomic selection seems to be working for the companies, but those goals might not be aligned to the public sector. And so in the interest of time, I think I'll skip over the funding slide and just say thank you, and I'll look forward to discussion.